Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. Coming up in a moment, the body of the last Israeli hostage has been brought out of Gaza. We'll speak to a representative of the Hostage Families Forum and to a journalist inside Gaza, and we'll ask what this might mean for the next phase of the Gaza peace plan. We've also got an insight into the bizarreness that is an election under a military dictatorship, an election in Myanmar.
We conduct the election free, fair, credible and transparent.
People I've spoken to are very scared, frightened. They feel they are forced to vote. They say they cannot say anything about the election. That makes it seem like it's not really fair.
No, it is not true. You can ask everyone. You can ask the question everyone. It is not true.
Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head on his attempt to find what is true inside Myanmar in about 35 minutes. First, though, the Israeli military says that it has retrieved the body of the last hostage in Gaza. It's a moment which could lead to the implementation of the next phase of the US-led peace plan for Gaza, to an opening of a key border crossing, to Israel withdrawing from the territory, to the disarming of Hamas and the governance of a new group of Palestinians, most of which, obviously, remains far further in the future. We'll look at the chances in more depth a little later, but this is also the moment when most of Israel will say, thank goodness, the return of the body of Rangvili brings an end to the agony of the hostage crisis, 843 days after it began, on October the 7th, 2023. The IDF released footage of their soldiers saluting and singing as they gathered around a coffin in northern Gaza containing the body of Rangvili. Israeli soldiers singing the national anthem next to the coffin of Rangvili. From his sister today, there was this mix of emotions.
Wow, I feel an insane sense of relief. I feel relieved. I am sad. I'm very sad that it ended this way. But it had to end at some point. I'm so happy he's coming back home. Rani's on his way. Rani is coming.
Lior Chorev is a senior member of the Hostages Family Forum, the campaign group which has pressured for the last more than 2 years for all 250-plus hostages to come back from Gaza. Who was Rangvili?
Ran fell in battle on October 7th when he was 24 years old. Ran was a member of the Israeli police, of one of its elite units, and he left early morning on October 7th. Although he was already injured, waiting for an operation, he decided to leave home to take his position, trying to defend innocent civilians that fled from the Nova Festival party. He fought almost alone against numerous amounts of terrorists, of Hamas militants. He was able to kill for sure more than a dozen of them, saving tens of lives. And eventually he was shot several times during battle and died. His body was kidnapped to Gaza, to the Zaytun area in the Gaza Strip.
It must be a day of extraordinary emotions for his family, who have been waiting so long, and so much longer than any other hostage family, to be reunited, albeit reunited with the body of Ran. Have you managed to speak to them today?
Yes, I've spoken to both Rani's mother, Talik, and his sister, Shira. This is, of course, a very, mixed feelings. They're bringing their beloved son to burial, but at the end of the day, Rani was our last hostage. And the fact that we were able to retrieve him and to allow his family to reunite with him and give him a proper burial within his community and family is, of course, highly important for everyone. And, the fear of remaining last and the chance that was there that we may never find Rani was something that disturbed us all. And I think that it not only will allow the Gvili family to start and recover and recuperate, but for the entire hostage family, this day marks an historical day, something that none of us believed 2.5 years ago, that we would be able to retrieve all of our 255 hostages taken by Hamas to Gaza.
And that was something that, you heard time and time again from the families, which was, you know, even at those moments when they were feeling the joy and relief of getting their loved ones out of Gaza, that they were saying, we will not rest until the last hostage is home.
This goes back to the basic DNA that makes us who we are as Israelis. We don't leave any of our own behind. We have this sense of solidarity, one for all and all for one. This is not just a slogan from a movie. We have all been brought up to these standards and these values. And the fear of letting the Gvili family down and not retrieving Rani was something that was a moral burden on each and every one of us, whether we're volunteers in the hostage family forum or members of the hostage families. And, you know, when I got the news earlier today, it was not just emotional. I felt as if I could suddenly breathe again. This was a huge burden, a moral burden on all of us.
Maybe it's too early to ask you this question, Lior, but I wonder if you have given any thought to what comes next for you and for, in particular, for the hostages and their families.
It depends on whom, but I think three remarks should be made. One is that finally most of the families and the hostages that we were able to retrieve alive will start their rehabilitation, and this is highly important. The second remark is that the family forum is now going to be finally closed and adjourned. We have pledged to bring the last hostage back home, and we have done that. And the third remark is that now each and every family member will need to make his own decision regarding whether he or she wants to become active in politics or in public affairs. This is going to be a private decision made by each and every one of them. But I'm sure that many of them, we will find them in the public arena, because they not only brought hope, but they also see themselves as serving a higher purpose. And I think that we are already seeing some of them being engaged towards the upcoming national elections later this year. And others are becoming very much involved in public affairs.
And that was Lior Chorev from the Hostages Family Forum, where he has been over the last 2+ years, chief strategist and campaign manager. Let's go from Israel into Gaza. The Israeli government had said that it would reopen the border crossing at the south of the territory, the Rafah crossing point, once the last hostage body had been retrieved. So what do Palestinians crammed into the southern end of the territory feel about the prospect of that and the possibility of moving to the next phase of the US-led peace plan? Imad Koudeh is a freelance journalist originally from the southern city of Khan Yunis, now a little further north in the vast displacement camp at Al-Mawasi.
Well, the opening of the crossed border of Rafah means to me a new window to the world, because this crossed border of Rafah has been under siege for a long time. We are talking about more than 1 year and a half, May of 2024. So a lot of people did travel out of Gaza, and right now they would like to return back, but they do not have this kind of a chance. Since that time, they have maybe completed their medicine, they have maybe completed their education, they do not have any more money to spend there in Egypt, and they would like to return to Gaza, meaning Gaza, in our land, they can find a piece of a bread, they can find relatives to take care of them. Second of all, it means for me that the crossed border of Rafah is going to allow us to travel. We have a lot of students here in Gaza, they've got their scholarships after graduating from the high school, and they need to take this scholarship, they need to travel to the providers of those scholarships. People have been wounded during the war and their situation is really dangerous, so they need to travel out of Gaza to complete their medicine. We are talking about huge numbers. So I do have, for example, relatives, you know, those relatives to live in Egypt for maybe the last 2 years. They have traveled, they have Egyptian nationality, but they would like to return to Gaza as soon as possible. But first of all, they would like to guarantee that the future is going to be known here in Gaza. Because when they come back to Gaza, they will not find a place for themselves to live in, because all of their houses have been destroyed. For example, my village has been destroyed totally. So even if they allow us to return back to those places, we need, you know, a lot of efforts in order to rebuild a new Gaza, let me say, or a new village, in order to allow those people coming back from Egypt or other places around the world to find a place for themselves to complete their life here in Gaza. Because here in Al-Mawasi, there is no empty space for the Gaza people living inside Gaza. What about the outside Gaza? It's going to be so difficult.
Imad, can you give me a sense of what life is like for you and your friends and your relatives at the moment? Because obviously there's been a ceasefire for 3.5 months now. But, I mean, from what we understand, it's not as if there is a huge amount of supplies coming in to Gaza, maybe more than before, and also that there is still violence. People are still being killed. What's your experience?
Well, whatever words gonna come from my heart, they do not describe the difficult situation we live in here in Gaza, even though after the ceasefire agreement, because many people have been killed during the ceasefire. But after the ceasefire is different about before, because when you walk in the street at the moment, for example, here in Almawasi, at least you cannot feel worried. After the ceasefire agreement, people started to have very big hopes inside their hearts. And every day when we sleep at night, we say that maybe tomorrow is going to be better. If it is not tomorrow, maybe after tomorrow. And all the time we are ready in order to make it great again, as it was and it's still. So Gaza is one of the most beautiful places around the world. Maybe that is why Trump would like to invest in Gaza to many projects.
Do you think that there is a chance now that with the return of this final hostage body, that actually we can move to the next phase of this ceasefire? I mean, can you really imagine that Hamas will disarm? Can you really imagine that the Israeli army will withdraw?
We are hopeful. We are positive about what is going to happen in the future. But that is not going to be easy. For example, before coming to this interview, Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, said very clearly the second phase of a ceasefire agreement in Gaza is not reconstruction of Gaza, rebuild of Gaza. No, it's the disarmament of Gaza, which means this man puts in his mind more and more plans. And if any of his plans will not be achieved, of course, he's going to put a lot of restrictions, a lot of challenges and obstacles in front of the ceasefire agreement. But we wait. More efforts and pressure from Trump, the United States of America. He is the only man has a word to say to Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, in order to go on. And of course, the whole international community, they have the ability to convince this man that everything can be very nice, but maybe you can use a diplomatic power.
And that was Imad Kudeh, a freelance journalist, speaking to me from Almawasi, down towards the south of the Gaza Strip, but not as far south as Imad is from. That's the devastated city of Khan Yunis. We'll be looking more about what this retrieval of the last hostage body might presage in just a couple of minutes here on NewsHour. Also coming up on the programme, how a certain endangered monkey species in Mexico is able to seek out a good feast and also communicate the good news to some of its neighbours. That's coming up in just a few minutes. Our main headlines this hour, as we've been hearing, the Israeli military has retrieved the remains of the last hostage from Gaza, a key condition of the agreement to end the war with Hamas. And hours after an apparently conciliatory conversation between President Trump and the Democratic governor of Minnesota, Tim Walz, the White House has criticized what it called hostile Democrats for the unrest in Minneapolis. We'll be in Minneapolis in about 15 minutes. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks. We're going to head back to our top story, the body of the last hostage held in Gaza, arriving at a forensic institute in Israel after being located and retrieved by the Israeli military on Monday. It's the recovery of Ran Gavili's remains. It's being seen as potentially a key moment in the Gaza peace process. Let's look at that more now with Yotam Confino. He's an Israel-based Middle East correspondent and author of a book on the country under Benjamin Netanyahu. Before we get on to the longer-term questions, how likely is it that the Rafah crossing in the south of the Gaza Strip will open both for people and for aid?
So let's start with people. It looks like it will reopen for pedestrians. That's what Prime Minister Netanyahu announced yesterday after a lengthy cabinet meeting. and after pressure from the United States. But in terms of fully reopening the border crossing for humanitarian aid, I think it's something that's going to happen slowly but surely, because Netanyahu is surrounded by ministers in his government who are all vehemently opposing any opening of the Rafah border crossing. So he made a compromise in a way. So this is the first thing we're going to see. But as your previous guest also said, Netanyahu is demanding that the ceasefire plan, the second phase of the ceasefire plan, be implemented as was agreed on, which means that Hamas needs to disarm before you can start reconstructing. Now, Hamas has said over and over in the past couple of months that that's not going to happen, despite them agreeing to this in the first place. So I'm afraid that it doesn't look good. I spoke to an Israeli official this evening and I asked him, what do you think about the second phase? What do you think is going to happen? He said, listen, I really don't see any other scenario than war between Israel and Hamas again, mainly because there is no international stabilization force that is ready to go in and use force to disarm Hamas. So it doesn't look good, unfortunately. And this is also what I've been hearing the past couple of months with every official that I've spoken to.
So not a huge amount of optimism on the Israeli side about that. I guess the question is how far the protagonists can be squeezed by outside actors. I mean, whether there are pressure points as far as Hamas is concerned, and also, I mean, obviously, from the Israeli side as well, perhaps as far as the Americans are concerned.
Ultimately, Donald Trump has huge leverage. Everyone knows that. So Donald Trump now wants this to be over. He's already picturing Gaza becoming the next Singapore. Jared Kushner was speaking about it at Davos, how it's going to be an economic hub. The Board of Peace is already. So Donald Trump wants this to happen. He's trying to force this through, but he's not unrealistic. At a certain point, he will realize whether Hamas is going to voluntarily disarm or whether outside force is going to be used. And if he doesn't have any country in the world that's ready to send soldiers into Gaza, if you don't have an external Palestinian police force, which is apparently being trained right now in Egypt and Jordan, but we don't have any prospects of when they would be ready to enter Gaza, that leaves little choice but Israel. Israel will be the only actor ready to go in and finish off Hamas. So I think eventually Donald Trump is going to come to the realization that this is the option that he's left with, unless Hamas makes a U-turn and actually disarms.
How far does the retrieval of the final hostage potentially boost Benjamin Netanyahu in the forthcoming elections?
I would say it boosts him a lot. He's generally climbing back in the polls, and I wouldn't disregard him in the next elections. I would actually say that he has a good chance of being re-elected.
Yotam Confino, an Israel-based Middle East correspondent, speaking to me from Herzliya, close to Tel Aviv. Now, who'd have thought it? It certainly hadn't occurred to me, but spider monkeys apparently operate in a surprisingly sophisticated social system. The proof is in their sharing of insider knowledge about the best fruit trees in local forests. Scientists from Scotland and Mexico have spent 7 years studying the primates in Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. Sandra Smith Aguilar is one of the scientists involved. She's from the National Autonomous University of Mexico. She's a postdoctoral fellow studying social complexity in animals and was part of the field observations.
We did a good old people, including me, going out every morning and looking for a monkey subgroup and chasing it, well, following it, trying to all day for many hours, walk under the monkeys and see who was there. We get to know them. We identify them by their marks and their faces and just, you know, particularities they have in their fur or their expressions, etc. Every 20 minutes, for example, we would record who was there, who was with whom, and where they were. So spider monkeys go on with their normal everyday life looking for fruit. And they do it in subgroups. So they're going to be with other monkeys. And then throughout the day, they're going to split and join with others. And mostly at night, they'll come together in the sleeping tree. So the knowledge that they gather during the day is mostly knowledge about where they had been foraging. So where there's fruit, basically.
And how do they impart this information? How do they share it?
As far as we know, there's no intentional active sharing of information in the sense that there's no symbols or vocals that let another monkey intentionally know about this. But if I'm a monkey that the previous day didn't have the best of luck finding fruit, I might just hang around a little bit later in the morning till I see who leaves quickly. So if I had a good day before and I know where there's this great tree, I'm probably going to leave swiftly just directly to that place because I know where the food is. So by following others, monkeys can, you know, find these resources that were unknown to them the previous day.
Does that lead to resentment? I mean, do you see examples of those spider monkeys sort of looking over their shoulder and saying, clear off?
These monkeys tend to be very tolerant of others. So we have not seen any behavior like trying to hide from others. The only scenario where these monkeys tend to hide is when they're going to have sex.
And is this a type of activity that you've seen particularly with spider monkeys, or is it more widely shared among primates?
Well, spider monkeys are interesting in how they're organized in the sense that they have these groups where with 30, 40 monkeys, but then they're hardly ever together. So they usually spend their time in subgroups. And that's not unique to spider monkeys. I mean, chimpanzees do this thing as well. And it's what we call high degree of fission-fusion dynamics. And it's a type of social organization we also see in dolphins and hyenas and many other animals. But when we model mathematically what we would expect to be the optimal amount of space sharing and space not sharing or individual space known for monkeys to be optimizing how much they need to be together to have time to share information, but also be apart to have time to get to know or gather novel information unknown to others. It seems like what we saw with the monkeys approached in a very nice way what we expected with this model. And I don't know that we have seen that for other high fission fusion dynamics species. But this was very cool from what we found with the monkeys in this case, with the spider monkeys.
I can't get out of my mind the picture of these spider monkeys just waiting to publish their research paper into the odd behavior of these scientists studying social complexity in animals. But
for sure, I can't wait for it either, because I'm sure they get to see that some of us funky humans scratch much more than others, for example.
And that was Sandra Smith Aguilar, one of those people who is prepared to put in the hard yards doing the field observations in Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. This is NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. One of the world's largest airline groups has told the BBC that there is a growing problem with the rerouting of flights as airspace is closed because it crosses into a war zone. Lufthansa says that the ban on using Russian and Ukrainian airspace is having a measurable impact on its long-haul network, with typical detours of 1 to 2 hours and increased costs. Rick Kelsey has this report.
I'm currently flying over the top of the world. The flight is from Tokyo to London, and this route going over Alaska is common again, like it was in the 1970s when it stopped to refuel. But now it's often to avoid Russian airspace due to the Ukraine war. And this is not the only route that's changed.
Certainly, you know, if you have 4.9% of the world, of the 6 permanently inhabited continents, territory in conflict, that's significant areas of the world where there is a decision to be made of whether it is safe to fly over those zones.
Hugo Brennan is from risk intelligence company Verisk Maplecroft, who put together the latest conflict intensity report, which maps global conflict.
Ukrainian attacks on Russia, particularly on Russian energy infrastructure, using some of the Western supplied weaponry, you've seen a really big increase in kind of Russian territory. That was one notable takeaway.
The report shows that areas affected by armed fighting have grown by 89% over the past 5 years. Each additional minute of flight time leads to an average increase in passenger fares of $1.50, according to aviation experts at the German Aerospace Center. The BBC has now heard from Lufthansa, one of the world's biggest flight operators, who say their long-haul journeys are growing by up to 2 hours, and it must now continually adjust its network planning to keep its schedule stable. But it's not only cost, it's also emissions. Dr. Victoria Ivanikova is assistant professor in aviation management at Dublin City University.
If we will look on the flight radar 2024, we can see that aircraft are flying Russian airspace, Ukrainian airspace, and there are some points with conflict in the Middle East. And the total area of closed or restricted in use airspace currently is around 18 million square kilometers.
That's almost 11 million square miles.
Which is the biggest airspace segregation since the Second World War.
Most Western airlines are now banned from flying over Russia, which pushes up the costs. Gilbert Ott runs God Save the Points, who help people get low-price airfares.
An airline, you could say, would be less likely to make a seat available with points because there's so much more pressure to create that profitability rather than kind of break even on a flight with these changes, with these restrictions in airspace, because you have to care so much about each flight going out with the maximum profitability.
Figures suggest that until recently, airfares have changed little when taking into account inflation over 10 years. So you can still get deals, but the destination might be further away.
And that was Rick Kelsey reporting. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC. I'm Tim Franks. The standoff in Minneapolis is far from over. The fury from many city residents and their Democratic Party leaders over the militarized presence of immigration agents and the latest killing of a US citizen, Alex Preti, on Saturday, and the insistence from the Trump administration that these agents are simply trying to enforce federal policy, the deportation of illegal immigrants and foreign criminals. That standoff is not over. But are there signs of some moves towards lowering the temperature? Reports that Gregory Bovino, the boss of the Border Patrol, is set to leave Minneapolis. Donald Trump saying today that he'd had a good conversation on the phone with the Democrat Governor Tim Walz, that same governor who demanded that all ICE agents, as they're known, get out of his state. Add to that the intensity of the backlash, even from some Republicans, against this latest killing and the allegations not just that Mr. Preti should never have been killed with multiple shots to the back, but that the Trump administration had then rushed to paint him as a domestic terrorist bent on massacring law enforcement. Caroline Levitt, the White House press secretary, began her briefing to reporters today in typically robust fashion, saying in effect that Alex Preti's death was the fault of Minnesota's Democratic political leaders.
This tragedy occurred as a result of a deliberate and hostile resistance by Democrat leaders in Minnesota. For weeks, Governor Walz and the mayor, Jacob Frey, and other elected Democrats were spreading lies about federal law enforcement officers who are risking their lives daily to remove the worst criminal illegal aliens from our streets. Murderers, rapists, pedophiles, human traffickers, and gang members. Governor Walz and Mayor Frey have shamefully blocked local and state police from cooperating with ICE, actively inhibiting efforts to arrest violent criminals.
But then, when asked whether the administration still backed the assertions made at the highest levels from within it and made within a couple of hours of Alex Preti's death, that he was a gun-wielding terrorist bent on massacring law enforcement, Caroline Levitt had this to say.
This has obviously been a very fluid and fast-moving situation throughout the weekend. As for President Trump, whom I speak for, he has said that he wants to let the investigation continue and let the facts lead in this case.
Tom Bateman is our correspondent in Minneapolis. It's all very well for me in London to say perhaps there's been a shift in tone. What's his view?
I think there certainly is a shift of tone coming from the White House today, both from the president himself. That's borne out in part in the fact that he's now had a phone call with Tim Walz, the Democrat governor of the state. We know that Mr. Walz had been, he said, phoning the White House, talking to the chief of staff, Susie Wells, but this would appear to be the first direct conversation between the state governor and the United States president for a little while at least. So that I think feels like a preparedness for some sort of consensual, you know, some more consensus in parts of this issue than we've had in a while. And then you heard that statement. I mean, there's, you know, although Caroline Leavitt in the White House is still talking about hostile resistance by Democrats as being the cause of the tensions, we're now hearing them much more talk about the need for an investigation, not jumping to conclusions, but also to actually say the names of the two Americans that have been killed in the last 3 weeks. That's something actually that the protesters have been calling for. And there's certainly been very few occasions that I can remember where the, you know, Trump administration officials have been naming the two that have been killed in the last 3 weeks.
And in terms of the visit today of Tom Homan, who's he's a senior figure in the Department of Homeland Security, and perhaps not quite as polarizing a figure as some other key personnel there. What do you read into that?
Well, I think he'll be seen as a more sort of trusted and politically experienced figure to put as the public face of this immigration raid, at least in Minnesota. So far, that has been led by the Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, and also this man called Greg Bovino, who sort of describes himself as the commander at large of the Border Patrol. He, you know, he's been out on the streets of Minneapolis for weeks. A lot of social media posts. He likes to be videoed by his own teams, and that's sort of pumped out. And it's a quite an aggressive looking image that is presented about this immigration crackdown. Now, it feels like that approach is perhaps starting to be sidelined by the administration. There are US media reports, CNN reporting, unconfirmed at the moment, that he may leave Minneapolis in the coming days. So I think that would suggest, if that is finally confirmed, that there is a shift of tactics here, and at least in the messaging at the moment by the administration, if not of the policy itself.
And do you think, I mean, I was speaking on the program yesterday to a Republican congressman, a state congressman in Minnesota, who was, you know, sharing some unease about the events on Saturday when Alex Pretty was killed, and by the actions of some members of the Trump administration in rushing to judgment. Do you think that that sense of unease among some in the Republican Party is perhaps wending its way back to Washington?
I think it undoubtedly is. You know, on the Sunday programs yesterday, the governor of Oklahoma, for example, a senior Republican, openly questioning this policy, saying, you know, everyone agrees in his view with shutting the southern border and deportations, but it's about the way it's being done and to what end, he was saying. And I think, you know, the problem for the White House is the opinion polling is not helping them on this issue. There are now, you know, still a minority, but a significant chunk of President Trump's base that is pretty uneasy and uncomfortable about the kind of pictures they've been seeing, and in particular about the deaths of Americans. So I think that is playing into this discussion in the White House as well, with certainly figures who are pushing against some of the more hardline figures in the administration when it comes to immigration. And I think it's those, you know, within the context of this administration, those more moderate voices probably getting the day at the moment.
And that was the BBC's Tom Bateman in Minneapolis. If you happened to be listening to NewsHour this time yesterday, you might have heard me talking to our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head on the last day of voting in the Myanmar elections. Elections which pretty much the entire outside world view as a sham. They're partial, they're under a military dictatorship which seized power from the now banned parties of a civilian government 5 years ago, and the country is riven by a civil war. So, all in all, a weird election, and you could argue a meaningless one. But in the hands of a correspondent like Jonathan Head, there's much to gain from a visit inside Myanmar, even under the tightest restrictions. This is Jonathan's report from Shan State in the east of the country.
A small truck with a very large speaker reminds residents in the lakeside town of Nyongshui that it's time to vote. The people are joining together to build a new nation, goes the song. And indeed, inside the town's main secondary school, voters are guided by officials to where they can cast their ballots in what looks like a model democratic exercise. Except it isn't. A climate of fear hangs over this month-long, three-stage election, organised by the military clique which seized power 5 years ago, though that suggestion did not please senior election commissioner Kin Mong-woo.
We conduct the election free, fair, credible and transparent.
People I've spoken to are very scared, frightened. They feel they are forced to vote. They say they cannot say anything about the election. That makes it seem like it's not
really
fair.
No, it is not true. You can ask everyone. You can ask the question everyone. It is not true. That is, you are listening to false news.
But we found you can't just ask everyone. Few dare say anything after seeing hundreds of people charged under a law criminalising any criticism of the poll. It didn't help that everywhere we went in Shan State, we were constantly followed by military, police and other officials. Every restaurant where we ate, every hotel we stayed in, got a visit. And they were clearly terrified by this. There was almost no campaigning. And we found we were not allowed to see it anyway.
So we're on a really tiny road winding through the Shan Hills, trying to find the village where the Pa'o National Organization is holding an election event. We've been through two checkpoints, but we've actually been chased down by what appear to be, might be police officers, and they're now checking every aspect of our car and our documents.
Minglaba.
Minglaba. Major Joseph Nien.
Very nice to meet you, sir.
Permission.
We have permission, yes. Yeah.
The local army commander introduced himself and then questioned all the documents we'd been given by the government authorising us to cover the election in his area. He could not be persuaded to let us through. In an effort to shake off the surveillance, we took a boat out onto Inlay Lake. But soon found we were being followed even there by a military intelligence officer.
So we've been trying to talk to these ethnic Intar fishermen who work on the lake about the election, what their hopes are for the future, but our military intelligence escort is just behind us, and to be honest, they're too scared to say very much at all. One said the political situation is not good, the rest of them don't really want to comment. So we've come into a stunning gold temple right on the lake. Now, I came here 3 years ago and was struck then by seeing three pictures of Aung San Suu Kyi, photographs from when she visited. It's very rare these days to see her image in public anywhere. People are walking around looking at all the various images on the wall, but no one is going close to those photos of the deposed democracy leader. Even though we know she was enormously popular here on the lake.
This seemed the right place to confront our unwanted military escort.
Minglaba, can I ask, why have you been following us all the way across the lake?
It's for your safety, he said. As an officer, it's my duty, because you're foreigners. We did manage to lose him briefly in a weaver's workshop and spoke to a group of men eating their lunch, helpfully well out of sight. I asked them how business was these days.
Now it's not good.
No tourists?
No tourists. But 2019, 2018 is very good.
So do you hope that after the election it will get better?
Don't know.
You don't think so?
No.
Are people frightened to talk about the election?
Yeah, everybody like it.
Everyone's scared.
Yeah.
There is no sense that the people of Myanmar are being offered a choice in this election. They know that what they'll get will be continued military rule in civilian costume and with a parliament of sorts, but still with the repression, violence and intimidation which have blighted the 5 years since the coup.
Our splendid Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head with that report from Shan State in eastern Myanmar. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC. I'm Tim Franks. Scientists have today published the clearest map yet of the universe's dark matter. That might sound like a contradiction in terms. After all, this mysterious but hugely important stuff is dark. And yet, the scientists' plotting of where the matter is, how it threads through the universe, is higher resolution than anything before, and so should provide a greater insight into how the planets, stars and galaxies have been formed. Professor Richard Massey is co-author of the research and works in the Institute for Computational Cosmology at Durham University, which was involved in the study to produce the map. First, can you tell us what dark matter is?
Unfortunately, I can't really, because nobody knows. What we are beginning to figure out is where the dark matter is. But that's the first thing you do when you explore a new landscape. When you set off, the first thing you do is you draw a map and try to look at the lie of the land, see what's over here, see what's over there, and try and find some interesting regions that, you know, where the gold nuggets might be. There's no way of detecting it directly, as far as we can tell. But we can see the way it affects things that we can see. So, I mean, there's plenty of things that are invisible. If you look at the wind, you can't see the wind, but you know it's there because it's blowing the trees around. You can see the leaves falling around. Dark matter's the same way. It's really heavy and it has gravity, so it pulls things around that we can see. It pulls stars and galaxies and rays of light. It pulls everything around and moves things that we can see. And that's how we know where the dark matter is and can map it from looking at everything else.
So, okay, but are you able, as a result of this mapping, do you think, to draw conclusions on how it does influence the formation of things that we do know about, things like planets and stars and galaxies and so forth?
With this map, we're beginning to spot the first thing that we know that it does do in a very predictable way is it has gravity. It pulls things towards it. And as far as we can tell, and now better than ever, it behaves in exactly the same way as ordinary material does through gravity. And because of that, it has shaped the whole universe around us to make it inhabitable. I mean, when the universe started, it was this primordial soup, which everything was spread out. Fortunately, there were a few lumps of dark matter in there, and those lumps sort of congealed in this soup, and they sort of, because of their gravity, they pulled in all ordinary material. And eventually, that spread out ordinary material became concentrated into a few areas where there was just enough of it to create stars, create planets, and create the people. So it's sort of, it is responsible for life. It's the scaffolding in which all of the visible universe that we know about, everything that science has ever studied, all of that is built inside the dark matter.
Tell me what the next stage might be, you think will help you gain the next level of understanding into dark matter.
What people do when they try to figure out what something is made out of, whether they're, you know, starting from the earliest people living in caves to particle physicists and the CERN, they try and smash a couple of bits of it together and see where the bits fly out. You know, like you could do that with rocks, you could do that with particles. Unfortunately, you can't do that with dark matter because we can't control it. But fortunately, nature has done this sort of experiment for us. What we can find in the map is these interesting regions are places where there happen to be a couple of big lumps of dark matter that have smashed into each other. And we can literally map out where they go. Some of the theories of dark matter are that it doesn't interact with us, but maybe it interacts with other pieces of dark matter. And in that case, when two pieces of dark matter smash into each other, they will slow down slightly. They'll feel a bit of friction, like a car crash. And we're trying to find these patches of the universe to follow up again with other telescopes to go and study more. And maybe that will let us catch dark matter doing something else.
It sounds phenomenally exciting, actually. And you've drawn this analogy that you are the explorers.
Yeah, it's quite a privilege. And it is, but it is difficult. I mean, it takes a huge team to do this, both to build the telescope and then to make this map and analyze the data. It's taken a team from Europe and the US. There's a group of us in Durham in the UK and in Switzerland and in America. And, you know, we all have to work together for this. And it's just, I don't know, it's heartening perhaps somehow as well that when it comes to these high-tech fields like building satellites and searching the universe, we can just see further and chart our cosmic future better working together.
And that was Professor Richard Massey from Durham University. 100 years ago today, the inventor John Logie Baird gave the first demonstration of a working television in his lab in London. There is some debate, at least among Americans, as to whether it was the first working TV ever, but it was certainly the first in the United Kingdom. And come what may, it helped transform the entire world. Tim Muffett has this report.
Frith Street in London, where the man who made television itself possible was honoured this week. It was here that the late John Logie Baird carried out the experiments that gave the world true television.
January 1951, and the 25th anniversary of John Logie Baird's first public demonstration of what he called his televisor.
A real far-fetched realm of science, television. Sending pictures as well as sound by means of radio waves. Oh, what an absurdity.
Although this memorial plaque stands in the heart of London, his real memorial is in the forest of aerials that are springing up over the whole country.
To many, the idea of a forest of aerials ever springing up was far-fetched. John Logie Baird had spent years trying to transmit and receive moving images with a system of spinning discs and light-sensitive cells. In 1924, he managed to televise Stooky Bill, a ventriloquist's dummy. In October 1925, William Tainton, a 20-year-old office worker, became the first person ever to appear on television. 40 years later, he reflected on that very special day.
I was a bit scared of doing it, but he assured me that everything was all right and nothing to worry about. I was squinting my face up and things like that. I was limited, you know, allowed to move without getting burnt with these lamps. And Mr. Baird came running around from the receiving end with his arms up in the air and he said, "I've seen you, William, I've seen you. I've got television at last, the first true television picture. And you'll find that it'd been all the homes right throughout the world."
Feeling confident, on January the 26th, 1926, Baird invited a select group of guests to Soho for the first public demonstration. Businessman Oliver Hutchinson was the person televised that day.
Vision and sound are on. The station goes on the air.
A mighty maze of mystic magic rays.
But when the BBC launched its television service in 1936, it chose a different system created by Marconi EMI. Unlike Baird's, it was fully electric, no mechanical spinning discs. Instead, cathode ray tubes converted light into electric signals and back into images. This different technological approach to television was the one that took off and changed the way we saw the world. But the man with the original vision was John Logie Baird, 100 years ago.
Tim Muffet on the 100th anniversary of the first working telly. From all of us on NewsHour, thanks for listening.